Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. A big part of what we do here at On the Record is bring you local guests who share firsthand stories about some of the important issues that affect their lives. And our regular listeners know that on Fridays, we feature stories from a Baltimore institution, the Stoop Storytelling Series. Did you know you can now find the Stoop podcast at WIPR.org under the Your Public Studios banner? Today, as a special pledge treat, we're offering you a double scoop of Stoop. First, here's a story by Jessica Murphy Garrett about her unconventional path to motherhood.
I met Chris the summer after college, which seems, from other stories, like a popular time to meet your future spouse. I was working at the Colorado Shakespeare Festival, where I went to college, and I was prepared to move to Chicago at the end of the summer and make all my dreams come true or whatever. And my friend, who I was supposed to move with, her internship fell through, and it was a couple weeks before our move date, and I had nowhere to live and no one to live with. And someone at the Shakespeare Festival said, "I think Chris is also moving to Chicago. You should talk to him." And I found him at a party, and we'd never really spoken before. And I said, "Hey, I heard you're moving to Chicago. Do you know anyone who needs a roommate?" And he said, "Well, I'm living with my friend, but three's cheaper than two." And then I blinked, and we were living together. And we lived together in Chicago for a couple of years in the way that you do in your early 20s. And we were dating a bunch of people and drinking way too much and smoking way too much weed. And I was a preschool teacher at the JCC, and I would bring home a different cold every week. But also it was the JCC, so I would bring home a fresh challah every week. And so it was kind of a wash. And one night, we got so drunk that we made out and fell asleep on my living room floor. And a lot of things could happen after a story like that. I think a lot of great love stories start like that. We got in a huge fight and sort of vowed not to be friends ever again. And we were able to hold it together through the end of our time living together before I moved here. We held a prom in our house. My prom date showed up in a shirt that said "beer slut." It was very early 20s. And I moved here. And over the course of the next decade or so, we were able to repair our friendship after that drunken makeout. And we became very close, and we visited each other, and we lent each other money, and we even worked together a couple of times. I was sort of rounding the corner to 35 when I'm told that your fertility stops dead in its tracks. And that's not true, by the way. And I knew I started having to think about my life and if I wanted a family. And I was dating a bunch of people, and they were all great. Well, okay, some of them need to jump in a lake, but that's a story for a different stoop. And none of these guys wanted children or were ready for children. And I said, okay, I will do this on my own. That is what I will do. That is where we are in our lives. So I thought, I have a good job and good insurance. And so I go to the fertility clinic, and they said, "You're good to go." And I said, okay, I'm going to get inseminated. And I was prepared for that. And then I got a letter from my insurance company that said, "You will not get inseminated because here at this insurance company in this state, we don't pay for that if you're not married." And I thought, that's and this has to be illegal. By the way, it's not, or it wasn't. A lot of great people have worked on it since then, but there are still a lot of loopholes, so buyer beware. And I was indignant, man. I was righteous about this. I took a picture of that and I put that on Instagram. And men love that, by the way. And I immediately got a message from Chris that said, "So, if all you need to do is get married, let's get married." And I laughed, and I said, "Well, you know, my last proposal was from a guy I met at Joe Squared who told me he wanted to wear my skin, so proposal-wise, things are looking up." But I laughed it off, and then he said, "I'm serious. Think about it." And I thought about it, and We talked about it over the next 10 days. We talked about what the benefits of being married could be. I would get to have a baby. He would get health insurance, some stability in his life, a place to go, things to do. He was living in Florida and feeling kind of stuck there, and he said, "I'll come and help you with the baby." And I said, "Great, okay, we're doing this." We were engaged for 10 days. We got married at the courthouse up here. We had a great wedding day. We, you know, the wedding was fantastic. We partied all night. We fell asleep entwined as he whispered the sweet nothings that I think any bride of the last almost 20 years knows all too well. "My wife." It was annoying. He moved in, and I thought the right thing to do is to ask him, is to give him first right of refusal on being the sperm donor, basically. And I said, "You know, since we're married, I don't know if that's something you want." And, you know, he said romantically and wistfully, "Nah, I'm good." So I bought sperm with a credit card, as one does. And I started going through fertility treatments. And before I go any further, I just wanted a little interlude and to answer the question that everybody always has, which is, do my husband and I have sex? Much like many of you, I'm sure, no. We don't. Sex, to me, right now, is like a lot of other things pre-pandemic and pre-parenthood. It's like a nightclub dance floor. Sweaty and fun, but it's not safe right now. You know what I mean? I love sex. I miss sex. Again, that's a story for a different stew. He moved in shortly before the pandemic began. The pandemic began. We fought. He got into a biscuit-making phase. He got gallstones. We watched 11 seasons of NYPD Blue. It was a whole thing. Fertility treatments restarted. I was very blessed. I got pregnant right away. You know, I could have done this on my own. I could have. It would have been a lot harder and a lot lonelier. And I had someone to push on my lower back in those late stages of pregnancy, when you really need someone to just push on your lower back. I had someone to arrange the furniture to accommodate all the baby stuff and then rearrange the furniture when I had a temper tantrum from being 5 months pregnant and deciding that all the furniture looked wrong. I had someone to look up whether Orange Julius still exists. It does, but only in select Dairy Queens. And as much as I hate to say it, I had someone there at the hospital so I could be like, "You just wait till my husband hears about this." Which is always a nice thing to have. And, you know, when the time came and I was in the hospital and I finally decided to have a C-section after labor that was just not progressing, I had somebody there too. I had somebody to hold my hands when my arms were trembling from the anesthesia and the fear. I had someone to look at. I could look at his signature black framed glasses fogging up over his mask as they pulled her out, and for those agonizing seconds when I couldn't hear her cry. And then finally, you know, that noise, that wonderful noise. And she, the umbilical cord had been wrapped around her neck, and so they took her away. And I remember saying, "What if she's lonely?" And so he went and he stayed with her and he held her hand and her fingers curled around his in the way that mine have so many times over the last almost 20 years. So later this year, as according to plan, my husband and I will be getting a divorce. It's bittersweet, but you know what? It's not unlike other stories, right? Boy meets girl. Boy moves to Chicago with girl, boy and girl kiss, and then they get in a fight for like 5 years. Boy and girl have a lifelong friendship. Boy helps girl. Boy moves on to do other things. Girl is scared and a little bit lonely and very tired, but girl has made other girl, right? Everything is chill. Everything is good. And my daughter is 8 months old. She is perfect. She is amazing. She is awesome. She giggles. She coos. She lets me eat her little toes. Her favorite food is spinach empanadas. She will stop crying when she hears Nelly's Ride With Me. Listen, she's amazing. My daughter did not and does not have a father. But thanks to a marriage designed to end, during those first hours of her life, cold and alone, she had a friend. And she always will. Thank you.
That was a Stoop story from Jessica Murphy Garrett about becoming a mother, the power of lifelong friendship, and marching to your own drum. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're treating listeners today to a double scoop of Stoop storytelling. Stoop stories are a regular treat you can find here each Friday at On the Record. You might know that Stoop stories can range from hilarious to heart-wrenching. This next story falls somewhere in between. And a note to listeners, the story includes references to suicide. Up now is Ariane Rice, who talks about striking out as a newly ordained minister and discovering what they didn't teach her at seminary.
Everything about my job when I started was unexpected, and that was especially true the first year. It was my third week on the job, and my boss, the senior priest at my church, was on vacation, because that's what you do in the church. When you're new, they throw you in there, and then the boss goes on vacation. And the phone call was put through to my office, and I picked up the phone. Hi. And the gentleman introduced himself to me, or reintroduced himself to me, because I had met him earlier on a Sunday, but I couldn't remember anybody's name. And he said, two nights ago, our son jumped off the overpass of 15501. Can you come to our house to help us plan the funeral this afternoon? So I hung up the phone, and my hands were shaking so badly. And I thought, I have no idea how the f*** to do this. So I called my good friend in New York City, who is also a priest, and I said, how the f*** did they tell us how to do this in seminary? And he said, they didn't. Because that's not what you learn in seminary. You learn a lot about rules and the ways to do church right, and none of that means when you're outside the church. So I went to the house, and I have to admit, the entire time I was driving to their house, all I was thinking about was myself. What in the world would I say? I could barely process this tragedy of these parents, a young adult son who is now dead, and I had a brand new-ish young child at home as a parent. This was far too enormous for me, and I had no idea to expect when I got there. So I walked into the kitchen, and the mood was relatively light, which surprised me. And they were bustling about, and the mom was opening and closing cabinets looking for something, and the dad was unloading the dishwasher, and somebody sat at the kitchen table who was introduced to me as a friend and a neighbor, and she offered me a cup of coffee, so I just sat down, and they just started talking. And the mom started telling me everything about their son and how he had been dealing with mental illness from a very young age, and they had had doctors and hospitals and interventions, and as he had gotten older, they eventually got to a point where they realized they probably were not going to be able to save them, and they were going to do the best they can, but at a certain point, he was on his own. And I just sat and I listened, and all of a sudden, the mom said to the husband, "Hey, honey, do you know where the duct tape is?" And he said, "No, I don't." She's like, "Well, do you think we need duct tape, or will the Tupperware seal work?" And I sat there going, "What the hell are they talking about?" And the neighbor looked at me and she said, "Oh, so Kevin's going to have three services, and they're dividing his ashes right now into three different Tupperware containers. So there'll be the funeral at our church this weekend, then the funeral in the other state for the rest of the family, and then the college friends want to have a memorial in New York." And I immediately remembered my rules that they taught me in seminary about how you're not supposed to do that, but I kept my mouth shut. And then they sat at the table and they told me more incredible stories about their son. And there was lots of crying and there was lots of laughing. And they handed me the Tupperware at a certain point, and I left to bring it to church. And as I walked to my car, I just remember thinking, okay, and I felt like I was holding a person. And when I got to my car, I didn't want to put him on the floor because that seemed disrespectful, but I was concerned about him being and moving around on the seat. And I was like, the seatbelt seems like too much, so I'm just going to take my prayer book and put it in front of the Tupperware, which I did. And then I sat in my Scion and I turned it on, and I surprised myself by saying, hey, Kevin, so what music do you want to listen to as we drive to church? And I started laughing, and I was like, is this being a priest? And about 15 years later, it kind of is. Thank you.
That was a Stoop story from Ariane Rice about holding fast to faith and making it your own. We have more information about the Stoop Storytelling Series at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on the record. On this first official full day of autumn, I hope your weekend is plentiful.